I was sitting at home the other night trying to work on material for this show. Somebody comes in the porch and knocks on the door. Naturally, the dog goes crazy. I grunt my way up from the couch, peek out the window. You know, in that way, you kind of hope maybe like you can see who's there, but they're not going to be able to see you back. And of course, right there, like right there, is this guy grinning back at me, and he's got a clipboard. So you get that feeling, right? I don't need to sit on my couch thinking about Charity. Charity, of course, came looking for me. This is In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. This time it was something new for me. A food shelf based on a bus that pulls into lower income neighborhoods to distribute organic produce left over from area co-ops. I had to give him some points just for creativity. And I had to give him 50 bucks. When it comes right down to it, most Americans are like I was at that moment. We have a hard time saying no. We are, and people get ready to wave your flags here, we are far and away number one in the world when it comes to charitable donations. Not just in terms of absolute dollars, but in terms of the portion of our income that we give away. On that measure, we're twice as generous as number two, Great Britain. We gave $295 billion last year. That's about the same as the national income of Norway or Indonesia. And let me just say, at the start of the show here, that is awesome. Sure, we could argue about whether we're making up for government spending, or whether certain people give more than other people, whether we all could still give more. The fact remains, we give a lot. But how do we give? Where is all that money going? There's no all-knowing accountant with a master plan for dividing it up fairly. Do we just wait for whatever guy with a clipboard comes and shows up at our door? What are our priorities?
I see investment in culture as a way of improving the way of life.
I give to other nonprofits and to my church.
If we would focus on social institutions, I think we'd be better off.
If it's an organization that touched my life, I'm going to give them more money.
I mainly give money. Things are really busy, but I like to give more time.
Tonight, we're going to get behind the big, impressive figure of American largesse. We're going to focus in on some other numbers that take us deeper into how our world-leading goodwill gets spread around. Our house band, The Smarts, is here with some new music, and we've got some great stories and interviews coming your way. More than ever, tonight, our audience here at Minnesota Public Radio is going to be essential in helping us talk through some of the big questions around American charitable giving. So whether you're with us by podcast, radio, or if you're here in person, thanks for donating the next hour to us here at In the Loop. So let's take a spin through some odds and ends of American charitable giving. Our crack research staff here at In the Loop has been surveying the landscape for the trends and statistics that shape our giving. Audience, are you ready to play?
Let's make a donation!
Let's make a donation. Let's make a donation. Let's make a donation right now.
All right. Let's reveal our five categories for today's game. Furry woodland creatures. Disease of the week. Needy schmeedy. Artsy fartsy. And of course, charity potpourri. Audience, you're gonna be our contestants for the game this evening. Who wants to take a whirl here? Let's go right over here. Give us your first name if you would.
John from Minneapolis.
Now we've gone ahead and picked the first category for you. Let's get a question from Disease of the Week. All right, John, give us our question.
Last year, what were the combined salaries of the CEOs of the American Heart Association and American Cancer Society?
Did those two guys together make $500,000, $1.5 million, or $1 billion zillion humptillion dollars?
I'll say $500,000.
I'm sorry, that is incorrect. In fact, the answer is more than $1.5 million for those two. They did okay for themselves. Thank you very much, John.
Thank
and
you.
Pick another category for us, if you would.
Furry woodland creatures.
Hey, what? Okay, furry woodland creatures. What's your name?
Janice.
Okay, Janice, what's our question?
Which of these animals do not have charities raising money for them?
Here we go. Is it the Trafalgar square pigeon, the magazine mountain middle-toothed land snail, ocean krill or donkeys?
I'm going to go with Magazine Mountain Middletooth Land Snail.
You are correct. Applause are in order. The Magazine Mountain Middletooth Land Snail, try saying that five times fast. I won't. It lives on a patch of Magazine Mountain down in Arkansas. It's endangered, but amazingly enough, nobody's taken up the cause for that beautiful little critter. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, snail populations are one of the best indicators of the health of an ecosystem. Thanks very much, and if you move us ahead, choose a category.
How about Needy Schmeedy?
Needy Schmeedy. Yes, our next contestant, what's your name?
Jill.
Jill, all right, give us our Needy Schmeedy question.
What percentage of household charity is given to meet basic human needs like food, shelter, and other necessities?
A very serious question. Okay, options, 50%, 30%, or 8%?
50%.
The answer, in fact, 8%.
Whoa.
According to the Center on Philanthropy at Indiana University. I'm sorry, yes, and that's for all those needy people as well. Pick a category for us.
I'd like to go back to furry woodland creatures.
Yeah. Furry woodland creatures. Oh, these are nice. Okay, furry woodland creatures. We've got a contestant over here. What's your name, ma'am?
Hi, my name's Jane. How much does it cost to preserve 1 acre of rainforest?
Okay, how much does it cost to preserve 1 acre of rainforest? Is it $12, $50, $8,000, or really, just some elbow grease and some can-do attitude?
$50.
$50, you are right. That's at least according to the Save an Acre program. That money can cover land purchase and legal fees to add that acre to a conservation preserve. According to the website, it also makes an excellent birthday or graduation present.
For sure.
All right, choose our next category for us, please.
Disease of the week.
Disease of the week. Disease of the week for $50,000. And your name?
My name is Bill. Every year, colon cancer kills 20% more Americans than breast cancer. How many more registered charities are involved with breast cancer?
Is it 3 times as many, 10 times as many, or 20 times as many?
This is a no-win situation. I'm going to say 20 times as many.
You're right. 20 times as many. Yeah, it's a pretty huge disparity. That's according to listings on GuideStar.org, if anybody wants to check that out. Choose our next category for us, please.
Charity potpourri.
Charity potpourri. What's your name?
My name is Rosalie. Which of the following is a real charitable organization?
Is it the American Bullfrog Voice Institute, the National Odd Shoe Exchange, or the Odor Control Council of America?
I would say it's the National Odd Shoe Exchange.
That's right. Good choice. The National Odd Shoe Exchange. I'll just tell you a little bit about them. They were founded in 1943 during the polio epidemic of that time in order to provide shoes for people who wound up with different sized feet. And they're still around today. They provide single shoes as well for amputees. Rosalie, choose a category for us from the ones that are left.
I would like to hear some more about the Needy Schmeedy.
Let's hear some more about the Needy Schmeedy. Our next contestant on Let's Make a Donation. What is your name?
So I'm Nicole.
All
and
right,
my
Nicole.
Question is, which of the following were recorded donations at organizations serving basic needs in Austin, Texas?
Was it a package of purple nylons, boxes of caffeine pills, or a gigantic gorilla mannequin?
I'm going to go with the package of purple nylons.
You are correct. But in fact, you're only about one-third correct because there is a hidden option for some of these questions, and that is all of the above. Here's some details on them. The nylons actually were donated to a food bank where they were used to package potatoes. The caffeine pills and the gigantic gorilla were given to a children's shelter. Eventually, they determined the pills were not really suitable as a snack for the kids. And the gorilla, you know, they tried the gorilla out, and it made the kids cry. So they removed it. We have just one category left, and this is Artsy Fartsy. Give us your name, please.
John.
All right, John, what do we got?
Of all the money donated to the arts, how much comes from households making more than $200,000 a year?
53%, 72%, 94%, or by some freak of mathematics, 136%.
going to go with 94%.
You're right, John. According to a survey just done this year, 94% of money given to the arts comes from people who make more than $200,000 a year. And here's another little detail. One-third of all the arts money comes from people who make more than $1 million a year. That's all the time we've got. I'd say we got a pretty good grasp on charity. The winner is you right there. You win. You win an in-the-loop shout-out to your favorite charity. What's your favorite charity?
The United Way.
All right, in the loop, shout out to the United Way. Hey, thanks everybody for playing.
Let's make a donation.
Let's make a donation. Let's make a donation. Let's make a donation right now.
All right, the smarts, of course, here on In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. Kind of gives you a sense of just how much is out there that we consider charitable giving. Health, arts, education, neighborhoods. Furry woodland creatures, of course. The nonprofit world is huge. This gets us to our first big number that'll guide our look at American charity tonight. In the last 10 years, the number of charitable organizations in this country has gone up about 70%. We now have more than 900,000 public charities in this country chasing our donations. That's enormous competition to catch our eye and tug at our heartstrings. We've got two guys with us here to help consider what all this competition means. Yuri Naren runs ZN Consulting. It's a firm that specializes in helping nonprofits run better. And Mason Thielen hails from the commercial world. As a matter of fact, he's a vice president with Augeo Marketing, handles clients like Home Depot, Pepsi, and Best Buy. Thanks, both of you guys, for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And let's just say one more note about you. Both of these guys work with something called the LEAD Project, which is a nonprofit that focuses on getting young professionals engaged in the world of philanthropy. Let me start with you, Yuri, and both of you guys can jump in here if you want. I mean, just how cutthroat is it out there right now?
I guess the best answer to that is it's becoming more and more cutthroat every day. With so much competition and with money not following the trend of how many nonprofits are out there, it definitely becomes more competitive all the time.
So who's winning the competition? Does anybody have an advantage?
Well, I think the organizations that are able to or do take the initiative to sink resources into development and marketing, the side that Mason will talk about for the most part.
Well, let's talk about the marketing end of things. What do you do for some of the charities that you're talking about to help them sell their message? Let me give you an example to work with, something that seems to me would be extremely difficult to sell. Nonprofits that help inmates recently released from prison, say, get a fresh start, you know, find a place to live. What do you recommend for a group like that to try and be heard?
If I'm trying to get you to give money, we have to identify what's going to get, you know, John engaged versus, you know, you, Jeff. And I'm going to be able to pull on John's heartstrings in a much different way because I happen to know, you know, through research or diligence that John had a brother that happened to go to prison and had to re-enter society. I know he's got a much stronger propensity to donate to the organization than you, Jeff, who, you know, really has no affiliation or getting your engagement is going to be a very tough play, right? This seems very duh and commonplace, but oftentimes this is the oversight. An organization like this will go out into the community and just start trying to solicit donations, whether it's, you know, the door-to-door approach you mentioned earlier or, you know, a direct mail campaign of sorts.
When you think about charity, I mean, a lot of us, I think, would imagine, well, you play to people's altruism. You play to their sense of doing good. Is that true?
There's actually a concept that Yuri and I have kicked around at great length, referred to as the WIFM model, right? What's in it for me? And there usually is a selfish motivator, whether it's a business interest, a personal interest. You know, you want to be seen as part of the social elite because everyone else is playing in this organization or giving money here. Regardless of what it is, acknowledgement of the fact that the WIFM model exists in charitable giving is something that generally isn't acknowledged but is definitely there. And by the smirks in the audience, I think everyone acknowledges that fact, right?
Yeah, it could be, you know, T-shirts.
Exactly.
Yellow rubber bracelets. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know.
There's beautiful water bottles.
Yeah. Minnesota Public Radio water bottle sitting over there. Well, I'm going to pull on something that I think you shared with our producers along the way here, a sort of general rule of thumb that organizations try to get 90% of their contributions from about 10% of their donor base to focus on the big contributions. Why even go after the little guy?
Oftentimes that will feed into a very good major donor program so that you establish a relationship that's a little more casual with somebody first, and then you get to know them a little better, and then you bring them into the organization a little more, they start giving more and move people on up as they become more and more involved.
All right, Yuri Naren and Mason Thielen, thanks for joining us here on In the Loop.
Thank you.
Let's take a little bit different spin on charitable marketing here. We're going to step out of the tax-deductible realm for just a moment and focus on a much more immediate kind of charity. The competition for dollars is no less intense at those busy intersections where people on the street try to make a few bucks with the help of a cardboard sign.
When a retail outlet advertises, it's called marketing. When I go about trying to find funding for putting on my opening at Minneapolis Public Library, it's called fundraising. When they do it, it's called panhandling. But the purpose is the same for all three, which is to relieve you of whatever it is you have in your pocket.
That's Michael Allen. He's a photojournalist. And we're going to find out why that matters right now. Our producer, Larissa Anderson, is here to tell us what this guy, Michael Allen, has been up to. Larissa?
Well, Michael's put together a public art project, and it's got photos he took of 9 homeless people on display. Next to those are the cardboard signs they use to raise money on the streets.
Okay, so cardboard signs like Will Work for Food, that kind of thing?
Right, exactly. And then several artists got together and they reinterpreted the signs to create their own work of art. And those are also on display next to the original cardboard version.
That's an interesting concept. These cardboard signs people use inspire some artists to get involved. But how are these signs supposed to actually inspire drivers to give something?
Well, let me tell you about one sign I saw in the exhibit. Michael described it like this.
10x10 piece of cardboard. Oh, it's still smudged. He's outlined it in color, and it says, "The IRS took my jet, ! Yacht is next, please help." And he's got little waves underneath the word yacht.
I was tired of the same old homeless whatever and kind of tired of people's reaction to it.
David Drew made that IRS sign. He's been panhandling or signing on and off for the last year.
So that's when I started kind of a series of comic relief, I kind of called them, with the IRS one, and they were wildly successful.
He's pulling people in. He's using humor.
Barbara Belknap is the graphic artist who redesigned David's sign.
David is using a lot of the tools of marketing and even target marketing.
Barbara says that's partly because David used the IRS sign in April.
It was timely because it was during tax season. That was top of mind to his regular customers, the people who came to his regular corner.
David's sign also had a flip side, which helped him reach a wider audience.
The backside of the sign said, "Homeless, please help." So he had a straight version and a funny version. So depending on who drove up, he would use the side of the sign that he thought would get more attention.
But Barbara says there's something else about David's sign that really worked.
I think one thing that David does very effectively is he breaks through the fear. Often people are afraid. They see a homeless person. They're not really sure what's going to happen once that person gets close to their car. By using humor or by breaking down those barriers, I think he's effectively getting closer to people.
In her version of David's cardboard sign, the part about the IRS took my jet is an elegant, scripty, scrolly font. There's blue sky in the background, and it's framed in gold. Barbara says even though they may look different, her sign has a lot in common with David's.
Well, my sign borrows very much from advertising, from slickness, from the sort of keep up with the Joneses, and so does his. He's talking about his yacht and his jet. I just made it look very, very slick. I wanted it to look like an American Express or a Lexus ad.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
David says he's had a lot of success with his funny signs. And success for him isn't just about how much change he can pocket.
Even if I get a laugh or a smile out of somebody, it's an acknowledgement that I'm out there. And that, to me, is as important as getting a dollar or getting 50 cents. So I started tailoring signs to get that response, a smile or a wave.
Like the sign he made that said,
"Alien mothership left me stranded, need money for a spaceship."
Or this other idea he had for a sign that was,
just a simple checklist of things you can do to ignore me. Check your seatbelt, check your stereo, wash your windshield, call someone on your cell phone.
But David says his funny signs were so popular, they caught the attention of the cops, who eventually took his signs away.
So I've kind of gone back to the standard, you know, one-line deals, because after losing a series of different signs to the police, I got to the point where I just grab a hunk of cardboard and a marker and go with that.
So now he's standing on the corner of 46th Street and 35W in Minneapolis, holding a sign with simple block letters.
"Homeless, hungry, anything appreciated."
A string of cars wait at the red light. One woman hands David a couple dollars and a bag of potato chips.
Oh, thank you.
A guy 2 lanes over sticks his head out the window and yells, "Get a job."
Did you get that? I hope the microphone picked up that get a job yell. Some days you're out here in the rain and you're miserable and you wouldn't, you know, the tent to get a job is just more than you can take. And it gets hard.
But for the most part, David says the people on the road have been good to him. He says 90% of the support he's gotten over the last year has been from signing. Those donations range from spare dollars to Starbucks gift cards.
As a matter of fact, the last time I came out here, I came home with like 3 bags of all things I'd eat too, like peanut butter, jelly, bread. It was just like, wow. I mean, I actually just finished off the last of that peanut butter this morning.
David says there's a debate on the street about whether a well-made sign can bring in the bucks.
I had a guy tell me I made $35 with a blank piece of cardboard, and I thought, wow, does it matter what's written on there? And I think it does. I think people do actually take the time to read them for the most part.
So, the signs seem to be working for David. And Larissa, does he have any other marketing tricks for encouraging donations?
Yeah, he talked about presentation. He said eye contact was really important. And he also said he seems to make a little more money if he has access to running water and he can shave or clean up before he hits the streets.
And did he have any kind of insight into what types of people give?
Yeah, that's interesting. He said he was surprised to find that he was less likely to make some donations from people driving cars that were fancier or a little more expensive than from people who are driving cars a little more beat up.
Oh, naturally. I mean, they spent all the money on their cars, right? That's Larissa Anderson. Thanks, Larissa.
Thanks.
Larissa Anderson, of course, a producer for In the Loop, who, incidentally, I'm told, drives a Saturn. If you're interested, you can go to our website, minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. We'll point you towards some great photos that go along with that story. I'm Jeff Horwich, and you are listening to In the Loop. Tonight, you know, we're starting from this big number, Americans' world-leading charitable giving. And we're working through some other facts to think about where the money is going. Now, we're going to go to our audience here in just a minute, but first I want to introduce just one more angle. And I don't want to just throw it out there. Seemed to suggest kind of a special treatment. So I'm going to ask Morris, our drummer, and Joe, our bass player here, to come on out, put on some silly hats, and give me a hand.
I love my alma mater, and I've been true to my school. I helped reseed the quad and build their 13th swimming pool. I helped to buy the symphony a brand new concert hall. The proof is there, that brick that bears my name up on the wall. I stroll the art museum and I see my gifts at work. The painters and the sculptors I hold dear.
So dear.
When I attend the theater, it always makes me smirk to know I bought the seat beneath my rear.
My rear.
We love to give to culture, to things that we enjoy. Those causes we can hear or see or do. But while cultural giving's up, the social side is down. Remember there are other causes too.
Thanks, guys. Joe Weissman, our bass player. Morris Engel, our drummer, ordinarily. Joining in on, I guess, baritone and tenor parts there with me. The Smarts is the name of the band. We're going to hear a little more from them later in the show. Here are some numbers to give a little more context to what we were just singing about. Last year, American giving to the arts and to cultural causes jumped 10%. So did giving to educational institutions. Giving to social causes, the hungry, the homeless, that kind of thing, that fell by 10%. Giving for basic needs, by some measures, is already the smallest category of American charity. There's a little asterisk here we should mention, which is that in 2005, people gave a lot to victims of Katrina and the Asian tsunami, so maybe they pulled back on their social giving a little bit the next year. But the fact is, A good chunk of American generosity goes to things like private universities and major cultural institutions. Let's bring the lights up and talk to our audience here at Minnesota Public Radio in the UBS Forum. How do you feel about that trend? The fact that cultural giving is up, social giving not doing so well. Sure.
John from St. Paul. Now, first of all, I don't give much of my dollars to arts and culture, except for NPR, and I do that because I like In Loop.
Hey.
But yeah. I do give a fair amount of it to social change, social justice, social action, and it just seems to me that it makes sense, given what is happening in our society, to realize that if we don't take care of the folks at the bottom, we won't have a top. And I work in the business. I will admit that I work in the disability business, and folks with disabilities as a class are more in poverty than anywhere else in the country, and in any population in our country. There's two sources of dollars. One is government. And speaking as the government side, we have limitations in what we can do. And the more innovative organizations, the organizations that are beginning to create change, really do depend on private dollars so that they, in fact, have less strings. But I will admit, that is very difficult money to raise.
Well, that gets back to that the marketing conversation from earlier. How do you tell that story?
There's a formula. Here's a problem. Here's a better world. Here's a solution. And we can change this world, but you need to be part of it, and we have the tools to do it. And then, finally, you make the pitch. You ask for the money. You say, if you don't do it, it isn't going to happen. And then the question is, how do you make it human? Nobody gives money to statistics.
Thank you, John. Glad you're here. Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay. Tara from Minneapolis. I was thinking about the arts and culture giving as opposed to the need-based giving. And a big part of it for me is I give often to what I use. This summer, for instance, there were the floods in the Midwest. A lot of the farmers were affected greatly. I gave a lot for that, but in part, it's because I eat a lot locally. So I benefit directly from that. At the end of the day, after all of that giving, I look at what I have and I'm like, well, I can give some to the Red Cross, but there is actually a limit to how much I can give. So you have to sort of prioritize, do I want to give for need first or do I want to give for what I utilize first?
Thanks, Tara. That's kind of a nice way to move us into our next topic here. This idea of giving because you use, because you have that regular attachment to something. Let's dig into another number with a huge, huge influence on Americans' generosity. Maybe the big reason we are the world leaders in giving to charity. It's pretty obvious every Sunday morning. Or Saturday, or Friday, or whenever, depending on your faith. One-third of all American charitable money goes directly to our places of worship. We're listening here to North United Methodist Church in Minneapolis. When you exclude giving by companies and foundations, when you look only at the money donated by actual people and families, the proportion going to churches, mosques, synagogues, and temples is 60%. 60% of all the money that we give. Many Christian faiths, of course, recommend a specific tithe to the church. Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, they don't put so fine a point on it, but those institutions, let's face it, they won't thrive unless people contribute. This past Sunday at North United, Pastor Linda Coleman led people gently into the church's annual stewardship service.
Sermon on the Amount, that's what I've heard it called also. Whatever you want to call it. But it's the day that we ask you to look at what you plan to give for the coming year.
Now, North United is in a struggling part of North Minneapolis. The neighborhoods around there are dotted with boarded up, foreclosed houses. But the giving continues.
What surprises me are the people who faithfully give a dollar, $5 a week that I know don't have that. It seems like the ones who have the least tend to give proportionally the most.
Surveys do show giving to religious organizations is not as closely linked to income as something like, say, giving to the arts. Up and down the income spectrum, we give to our faiths. North United lets parishioners do something a little unusual. They can actually choose where their money goes. Church programs and maintenance, mortgage payment, or the mission category, which includes missionary work and charity. But by letting people earmark their donations, sometimes the church itself can come up short.
That means sometimes we have to cut back on other stuff. We don't have a secretary because we don't have the funding for that. Repairs sometimes don't get done when they should because we don't have the funding.
Now, like I said, North United is an exception to the general rule by letting people specify exactly where their money goes. This illustrates kind of an important point. It costs a lot of money for churches and places of worship to run themselves.
If you're thinking about supporting your church, the lion's share, I think, in most churches goes to the operation and mission fulfillment of that church.
Now, that's Patrick Rooney. He's the director of research at Indiana University's Center on Philanthropy.
Benevolences, money that they give to help the poor, that tends to be fairly small percentages of total church budgets. If your real goal is to help the poor, then it would be a much more direct method to giving directly to organizations whose primary mission is to, you know, help serve low-income households.
Now, Patrick's not saying there's anything wrong with giving to your place of worship. Just realize that most of the money you give probably goes for religious practice, either supporting the place itself or spreading the faith to others. If it's the social causes you care about, it's probably not the most efficient way to give.
I don't like the idea of my money being passed through a lot of hands.
That's Melinda Fike. She's a junior at the University of Minnesota.
Churches do help out, but I guess maybe I don't like the idea that when you give to a church, it's not specific where it's going.
Melinda's maybe a little bit unusual, a church-going young woman.
It talks about in the Bible that Jesus says to be in the world, but not of it.
Who does all of her charity outside the church.
Well, obviously, I don't have tons of disposable income, so I don't give a whole lot. But what I do give, I put a lot of thought into it. I mostly give my time and money to organizations that have, like, a direct impact.
Some recent contributions she made, Doctors Without Borders, and a campus group that's building homes in South Africa. Now, Melinda grew up with her parents giving a set amount to their church. As she got older, she wondered if church giving wasn't somehow a little bit different from charity.
I think people can give money to the church and maybe it be more like a duty rather than motivated by love.
Now, it's a kind of a delicate point, but there is a certain level of obligation involved with giving to your place of worship. Most Catholics, for example, are asked to give 5% of their income to the church. Many Protestant evangelical churches require 10%. Same goes for Mormons, so it's no surprise Utah is the number one state in the country for charitable giving. Islamic zakat and Jewish tzedakah are not required to go to the mosque or the synagogue. But let's face it, it's hard to sit there every week without giving something to support the place. Researchers have speculated whether this kind of compelled giving makes it a little different from what we normally think of as charity. And there's certainly no doubt it beefs up our national statistics. Still, you could argue, you know, passing the collection plate, it's not a whole lot different than enduring a pledge drive on public radio. You enjoy this service. You sit here listening every week. We're an important part of your life. And every now and then we come to you and ask you for money to keep this great resource going. Become a new or renewing member today. Let's get back to that Methodist church in North Minneapolis. Now the service is over. It's a potluck time. Everyone's lined up around a table full of crock pots in the basement. For Harry Mason, Stewardship Sunday, or stewardship in general, frankly, hardly feels like an obligation.
I make my decision and say, well, I can give this amount, and it's what I decided to do. So I'm not being forced or compelled to, but I give willingly and cheerfully.
Harry's part of a growing West African contingent at North United. In fact, he says the church helped bring him to this country.
I believe that I should give back to the church, and the church will have to give back to the community.
Harry says the church itself puts him in kind of a giving mood. It's kind of a spillover effect. And this is where the question of how much charity you get for your money gets kind of complicated. The aura of giving is all over this place. The lobby has a spot for food donations and a pile of donated secondhand items. Flyers for various causes are taped up on every wall, and there are tables filled with information on other charities. Surveys find that while religious people give lots to their churches and other places of worship, they also give more than non-religious people to secular causes. They're more likely to volunteer, and not just at the church. It's certainly not the only way to do it, but something about going to services seems to get people more engaged in the world. Down here in the church basement, there's something else going on that's even more difficult to measure. Patrick Rooney, if you remember him, the researcher from Indiana, he calls it social capital, a network of mutual support built around the church.
If I were to lose someone in my family, people would be bringing by plates of food and offering to help do errands and take care of the kids. And that's something that the government is not going to do. And that's something that my colleagues at work may or may not do. But it's something that religious organizations take on as a matter of course.
What's going on here is community, really. It's not exactly the same as charity, but even for a skeptic, it's easy to understand why it might be worth paying for. Let's go back to our audience on that note and bring the lights up here. Is anybody surprised by this statistic? 60% of our household giving dollars straight to churches, mosques, etc.? Yeah, right here.
I'm Michelle from Minneapolis. I think it was 2 weeks ago at church, the entire sermon was dedicated to telling us why we needed to give and the exact amount of our expendable income, what percentage should go to the church. So I'm not surprised. There's definitely a lot of guilt and obligation.
Well, you're conscious of it sitting there, obviously, that it's a little bit different kind of pitch. What's going through your head?
Well, I felt like I was in a sales pitch. I didn't feel like I was at church the entire time. It was just kind of, I felt like I was getting preached at about just giving money instead of feeling good about what you're doing.
So do you give? What's your response when you're pitched to that way?
I actually don't give to that church. I give to different organizations that I believe in.
All right, thanks, Michelle. Let's keep going on this question of obligation versus sort of willing charity. Yeah, right back there.
Hi, my name is Omar. And
where are you from, Omar?
I'm from Minneapolis, originally okay. From Lebanon. But
sure.
From my background, which is religion of Islam, part of our pillars of the religion is giving alms or charity. But the giving is 2.5% of your savings, not earnings. You give, for example, not only money can be given. You give money, clothes, and stuff, but very important thing is giving a hand to a needy. This is also a sadaqah or a charity. Mm-hmm. A smile in the street, like say salam means peace to you or something. So the ultimate goal of that is to please the creator, and your reward is basically in the second life. Smile to your neighbor, smile to your, and the smile is really indeed a charity in Islam. So everything you do that's helped the society spread peace and understanding and communication is also part of charity, not only money and material.
Islam is different from many Christian faiths in that it specifies that needs to go basically outside the mosque. On a functional basis,
okay.
How does the mosque pay the bills?
Basically, from zakat and from Friday sadaqah, or you go pray on regular day, anytime, like five times a day, you just open your wallet and you have a couple bucks, you throw them in the box, and it helps running the mosque.
So in your experience in the mosque, they don't put the hard sell on you?
There's a kind of, and Ramadan is used. Ramadan is a month of fasting, and the charity in this month is multiple fold. So if you give $1, it's counted as $10 or $700 or something like this. So it's encouraged people to give more in this month according to the Prophet tradition.
Kind of like a member challenge.
It's kind of like this. So you give in this month, and the mosque takes some money and allocate it. And then also the mosque has a specific day when you say, okay, the bills are such and such and such, and you run it. But it's not really the most important or most focused upon part of the donations and program.
Thanks very much. Glad to have you here. And I should say, you know, it's very difficult to speak categorically about religion, even about, you know, Christian faiths or about Islam, because different places of worship individually will treat things quite differently. Why do you think it is that people who are religious, who attend church more, tend to give more? Yeah, we have one right over here.
My name is Heather from St. Paul. I think the reason that people don't give is because of self-preservation. They don't give because they think they don't have enough. And in the church, there's a spirit of generosity that abounds. When you live into a sort of mindset of an abundance, you're able to share.
Thank you very much. Thanks to everybody who joined in here. You're listening to In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. And as usual, we asked our house band here, the Smarts, to take a crack at our theme this evening and offer us a little bit of music to help us make our way through the show. So I'm going to make my way back to my guitar here and help them out a bit. So this is the Smarts here on In the Loop.
Couldn't possibly think that I've ever done anything at all to earn even a fraction of the fortune that has always smiled down upon me. So it's obviously an obligation for a little something in return, though I will never come close to doing anything to set my mind free. Sometimes it feels like I'm trying to fill the ocean up with tears. I know that the difference I can make is so very, very small. Could it be that the real motivation for me is a selfish one? I suppose, who knows, but it's better than nothing at all. Dollar, give a dime. Give your blood, give your sweat. Give to give, give to get. Give a little, give a lot. Give whatever gifts you've got. Give even more than you think you can. Most of all, give a damn.
Smarts. The Smarts are Joe Weissman on bass and taking first vocal duties there, Morris Engel on drums singing second, and joining us tonight with the Smarts, Andy Crowley on keys. You're listening to In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. Our episode tonight, Charity, What Gives? Americans are number one in the world when it comes to giving money. We are not, however, number one at giving our time. Germany, Norway, Tanzania, all came out ahead of us in a study done a few years ago. The Netherlands was number one. The U.S., numero ocho, number eight. Only a quarter of us say we volunteered last year, and that number's been actually down over the 4 years before that. We're going to spend a little while thinking about this number. Why are we somewhat more stingy with our volunteering? Maybe we Americans need a little extra incentive to get us out there, building houses or serving up some soup. I can say this from experience. A group I had a little something to do with a couple of years back, a group called Single Volunteers, which has a branch here in the Twin Cities. It's a group for people who want to give of their time, and maybe, you know, maybe find a date while they're at it. We sent our producer Julie Seipel out to catch up with some single volunteers at the Salvation Army in downtown Minneapolis. There's just one thing. Everyone there was a woman.
We're wrapping gifts for the people that come into the Salvation Army Christmas Day, I assume. Yeah.
The men probably didn't want to wrap gifts.
Yeah, the population is more like 75% women, 25% men. Oops.
It'll be covered up with cake. It's really nice just to meet people that have the same mindset that you do.
This is not a dating service at all. This is just to volunteer.
Well, maybe.
Well, maybe.
I mean, you know, maybe, you know, there might be an opportunity to meet someone that, you know, that's initially what motivated me to begin the group. It really was. There's a maybe for me, okay? I'd be
I have a friend, too. She's Brenda and John, yeah. They met in this group, and they're getting married probably next year.
You meet people that, yeah, aren't your bar people, you know, that kind of are out there wanting to give to the communities. The quality is better.
I mean, usually you're busy at these volunteer events, and you don't have time to, like, be flirting and picking up people. And you know, so it doesn't really turn out to be like a meat market environment, you know. So.
My name is Ann Lusk, and I started Single Volunteers. There's nothing shady about it at all. Sometimes when you meet at a bar and it doesn't work out, once again, you spent time and it was for naught. With the Single Volunteers, it's, I had a good time, I cleared a trail. In doing the work, it almost deflects attention away from the necessary coupling because you have this third element. You're focused not on each other, but on this maybe doing the trail clearing, or putting the cans on the shelf. And it gives you an easier excuse to talk to the other person because you have that in common. So in a way, we could be more sly and say we have duped people into volunteering based on this promise that they might meet someone, though I don't feel anyone feels that they were taken in the end result.
That's Ann Lusk, who's the founder of Single Volunteers. Earlier we heard from three members of the Twin Cities chapter, Deb and Bonnie from Minneapolis and Linda from Blaine. Our producer Julie Seipel put that together for us. Now, people volunteer for a whole bunch of reasons other than just to find a date. Sometimes they volunteer out of necessity, as was the case for David Jonas, our buddy here in the loop. Hey, David, how you doing?
Hey, Jeff, you look fantastic.
Thanks. I'm sure our radio audience can appreciate that. So, David, I hear you're logging more volunteer hours than you ever thought you might.
You know, I didn't mean to become a good human being. If you had told me coming out of college that I'd be working 40 hours a week teaching kids how to read, I'd have questioned your judgment. After graduation, I was ready to break into the high-profile world of public relations. Corner office, drinking lattes, winning wide acclaim for orchestrating JCPenney's sublime fall advertising campaign. 8 months and countless rejections later, I had hit rock bottom. So it came to pass. I applied for AmeriCorps. For those of you who don't know, AmeriCorps is like Peace Corps, except you don't go anywhere. You're basically a paid volunteer. I had an interview within 24 hours, and I nailed it. The job was mine. After all the hoops I had to jump through just to get rejected from other jobs, I was kind of expecting more of a challenge. There was no follow-up interview, no reference check, just welcome aboard. This was going to be ridiculously easy. Then I got my first assignment. We want you to set up a literacy program for 30 kids, ages 3, 4, and 5, by the end of the week. Oh, and they don't speak English. Yeah, maybe not so easy. I was clearly in over my head. Here I was, in a room with a horde of hyperactive East African children, trying to teach them what sound a K makes. And the whole time, I wasn't even getting a paycheck. I get what's called a living stipend. That's like $6 an hour before taxes, which means I'll be eating ramen and frozen chicken nuggets for a long time. But after a year with these kids, I figured out how to teach them the basics of reading and writing. What I lacked in training, I made up for in gumption and a chest full of puppets. You'd be surprised how much vocab you can teach a kid with a puppet. As a professional volunteer, I've gotten used to people complimenting me for the work I do. They say, good for you, and you're a real hero. But in reality, I'm not doing this because I'm a noble person. I'm doing it because, like most people, I like having money to pay for food. Don't get me wrong, I like what I do. I know it's important. But when my friends ask me what my long-term plans are, I say, I'm going to finish out my next 2 years. Then, I'm never going to help anyone ever again. I know that sounds bad. Let me explain. According to one study, the average volunteer is worth about $19 an hour. Remember, I get six. So it's kind of like I'm donating $13 an hour, 40 hours a week, for 2 years. That's $54,000. Money, of course. I would never donate if I was actually making it. So that's nice. I guess. Sure. It sucks I couldn't get a real job, but I'm glad things happened this way. The way I look at it, I've done my part. My karma bill is paid. And when I get out, I can do whatever I want. I'm just gonna sell out completely and make crap tons of money. So there I am. I got the corner office, the latte, the ulcer from a 70-hour work week. Some lackey comes in and asks me to volunteer for some cause or other. What do? I slowly pull out my checkbook, write a digit followed by a few zeros, and have someone else do the work for me. Guilt-free.
That's David Jonas, professional volunteer, future check writer. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
You're listening to In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. We're talking about this different kind of charity. By show of applause, who in here volunteers? This is a do-gooder audience we have here at Minnesota Public Radio. Who wants to tell me a little something about what they do? Oh, sure, right here. Give us your name, where you're from.
Anthony from Cambridge. I am a member of Engineers Without Borders. It is a nonprofit organization where engineers get together and do projects for those in countries that need engineering. We're providing water to a city in Guatemala that doesn't have clean drinking water.
And did you do much volunteering before that?
No.
Interesting. So you're able to find something that plays right into what you do for a living.
Exactly.
Pretty cool. Thanks. Let's get somebody else. I think we had one right. Do we have one right up here?
Hi, I'm Janice from Minneapolis. I have a radical idea about volunteering. I visit my grandma at the nursing home, and then I visit the other people who are at the nursing home too. And I guess my idea is that I wish more people would go out and visit their grandparents or their aunts or their uncles in the nursing home, and then maybe visit somebody else there too.
You have a channel to a kind of a volunteering opportunity, sort of.
Yeah.
Like some of the other things we've been hearing tonight.
Absolutely, yeah.
A lot of people in our audience here are younger. And I'm wondering, anybody, of course, of any age can speak up on this question, but volunteering and giving of our money, do you think young people think about it differently? Yeah.
My name is Paul, and I'm from Minneapolis. And I should disclose, I work with the Charities Review Council.
Okay.
But recently I volunteered with a group called Students Today, Leaders Forever, straight out of the U of M. But this group, they want to be much more involved. It's very common to see people now who won't just want to give and write the check, but they want to be there and actually donate. And then after the donation, they want to stick around. And then they want to, and what we hope, move up to serving on boards and taking votes and taking responsibility. So I think we are seeing changes, and they're positive.
Thanks very much. One last big question before we move along. This assessment, the thing we've based this entire program on tonight, the notion that Americans are, to some extent, the most generous people on earth. Do you buy it? Some groans? Let's go back. We got a hand up in the back.
Well, I'm curious.
And your name and where you're from?
Oh, yeah, Gabe from Minneapolis. I'm curious how much of our generosity stays within our borders and how much of it goes overseas. My impression was that not as much of it goes overseas as from other countries.
Yeah, I think your impression's correct, Gabe. In fact, a lot of people do give, like to give close at home to their communities. International giving is a, surprisingly, as we were doing research for this show, surprisingly small portion of the overall pot. Yeah.
John Paul from Woodbury. I think it's very interesting how in debt our country is, yet how much we give. It seems to me that a lot of times people might be wiser taking the donation they were about to give and paying off their debt. I mean, the whole country's in debt.
That's a good point. Thank you very much. Audience, give yourselves a round of applause. Everybody who participated tonight, this is a wonderful show. We should, and we do, we think hard about how much we're giving. And we think a lot about how we're giving. Part of what we wanted to do tonight on the show is to turn a critical eye to the fact that there is no grand design for where our money goes. It's a product of all of us making individual choices. And there's nothing more American than that. We give almost $300 billion a year, people at all income levels, and it keeps on growing. This show's been a little critical, a little on the serious side, but you know, this is In the Loop here, and we want to send you off on the right note. Giving to charity, you know, it makes you a part of something bigger. Whether you're giving time or giving money, it just makes you feel good.
Get out, get out, get out, get out.
I'm hot to make a contribution. Find the solution. And baby, I can't hold back much longer. It's getting stronger and stronger. An important part of living is charitable giving. Charitable giving, yeah. Makes me feel so fine. Hey, helps relieve my mind. Yeah. Charitable giving, baby, it's good for me. Charitable giving is something that's good for me. Whenever someone comes knocking, or I spot a cause that needs a little help, you see, there is something I can do. I can whip out my credit card and I can give some money, baby. I don't need no t-shirt or mug. No, I don't even need no, don't need no thank you hug. If you're having a little trouble just believing, well, open up yourself and try some charitable giving. Let's give some tonight. Check up, check up, check up, check up. Got to give it right. Get up, get up, get up, get up. That's our house band, The Smarts, behind me. Making me sound awfully sexy about a non-sexy topic. More about them at thesmartsband.com. Thanks again to Andy Crowley sitting in tonight on keys. You can join the network of listeners who help us build the show. Subscribe to our podcast. Check out the Loophole blog. Get tickets to our future tapings. All that stuff. It's at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. In the Loop is produced by Julie Seipel, Sandon Totten, and Larissa Anderson. Our interns are Bradley Campbell and Anton Friant. Thanks to Molly Bloom, Melody Yang, Andrew Haig, and Preston Wright from Public Insight Journalism. We get multimedia help from Christina Schmidt. Our photographer is Jeremy Pavlik. I feel like I should get a little more sultry with my delivery. Our technical director is Josh Kubasta, with engineer Maury Jensen. And our live producer tonight, Nancy Hakawaki. Jim Gates is our editor. Our senior producer is Mark Brule. Production of In the Loop is supervised by Leith Bishop. Our executive producer is Michael Scholar. Thanks to our guests, of course, our extraordinary audience here at Minnesota Public Radio tonight. I'm Jeff Horwich. We'll see you next time in the Loop. Hey, everyone. This is Jeff. Hope you have a great Thanksgiving. Because of the holiday, next week we're going to bring back one of our favorite shows from this fall, an episode called Your Exposed Life. We'll be busy getting ready for our final three episodes of the season. The next taping is November 29th, and we're embracing the politics in the air with a show all about the flip-flop. Join our Public Insight Network, help us out with ideas, and get your free tickets to be in our audience at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop.